91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. There's some sort of medical study to justify any belief. Red meat's a killer. Cannabis eases chemo. Tuna's loaded with mercury, but salmon oozes good omega-3. Take aspirin for your heart, but it may promote stroke. Coffee is a curse. No, coffee is a boost. A juice cleanse works wonders, but an annual physical may well be needless. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. We'll speak with journalist Jeff Wiltzer about his two-sided book, Good News About What's Bad For You, and the inverse, Bad News About What's Good For You. It's bad to be a couch potato, right? Then why are naps considered so cool? We'll have lots more of this after NPR and regional news.
Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. It's a full-time job just keeping up with what's supposedly good for us as well as what's considered bad for us.
Bonnie, remember when folks hopped on that anti-egg bandwagon? Well, most have jumped off. Or how about daily aspirin for a healthy heart? Well, it could lead to stroke.
Should we take daily vitamins, or are they superfluous? And shouldn't we spurn evil gluten?
Oh, and what about the vices of alcohol, cannabis, and pornography?
With us now is writer Jeff Wiltzer. His new book, or let's say his new books, are The Bad News About What's Good For You and
The Converse. The good news about what's bad for you. We'll try and keep that straight. Jeff Wiltzer's in the studio at NPR New York. Welcome.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Good to have you. Well, it's fun. The books are fun. Surprising at times, but you also have a really kind of clear, serious message in here. So just tell us what moved you to write this?
Sure. As you mentioned, and like a lot of your listeners feel, I'm guessing, it's confusing and frustrating seeing this seeming whiplash in the world of health every week. Like, oh, soy is good one week. Next week, soy is bad. Fish is good. Fish is bad. I'm like, wait, which one is this? Why are there always studies that seem to contradict one another? So I kind of wanted to take a deep dive in this and put it all in perspective for the readers who are confused like me.
We just want to point out just that you're not a doctor, you're not a health and fitness expert, but you did interview many of each for the book, right?
Exactly. You know, as I say in the book, I haven't even seen that many episodes of House. So I am not giving advice based on my own schooling. It's more I've had many conversations with health experts in the world of food, nutrition, exercise, and even psychology and vices. So I kind of spoke to always experts to get a feel for, okay, what should we trust? Why does it seem that things are always upside down, and why does black seem white and vice versa?
So, Jeff, let me jump on the, bad stuff, or elaborate on what should make me feel bad. Profanity, sloppiness, procrastination, gossip, and complaining. But all those have good sides, I'm glad to hear.
Yeah, one refrain I found again and again speaking to the experts is most things in life, whether in food or habits, have a trade-off. And we tend to simplify and oversimplify and think this is good, this is bad, therefore I should never eat this or always eat that, when the truth is more complicated. And that sounds at first like, oh, that's annoying and frustrating, complicated. But I think the good news is that it actually lets us not beat ourselves up for quote unquote bad habits that aren't really so bad. Let's take one that affects many of us: alcohol. Right? We've we've all heard, well, red wine can be good for your heart, but no one really believes that, right? Like, I think that I heard that years ago, and it sounded like an old wives' tale. And I think most of us tend to think that alcohol is generally pretty bad, even though it might supposedly be good for our heart. So I was surprised in interview after interview, in study after study, to hear actually, no, not just red wine, but really almost any kind of alcohol in moderation. The studies have shown a very clear link between that and longer lifespans, better heart health, and other assorted health issues. So maybe back to your original question, maybe if we have a beer now and then or a whiskey now and then, we shouldn't feel like, ah, oh, geez, I know I'm not being that healthy, but I'll have this. Instead, we can feel, okay, this is actually, in moderation, not bad for me. So I'm going to just enjoy it.
Doesn't it all really boil down to, Jeff, though, that we're kind of stuck with boring moderation?
Well, it's tempting, and that is certainly one takeaway. And part of me hates that because I'm sick of folks saying, "Oh, just do this in moderation." I acknowledge how frustrating that simple soundbite can be. What I think, though, that the richer picture here, and I try and walk through in the book, is that there are these trade-offs. And one reason why the news can seem so darn bipolar is that one study will kind of indicate the negative consequence of a food, or let's say aspirin. And then the next week, some different study might hint on the positive consequence of the aspirin. Both studies can actually be correct, but it depends upon whether you're emphasizing the positive or negative trade-off. So I think that when we look at food and drink and things like exercise, and we try and understand why studies seem so different, it's not just that moderation. It's also, let's recognize that few things are a unilateral good or unilateral bad. We kind of have to take the good with the bad and not get discouraged that things that we enjoy also have a dark side and vice versa.
Well, another important point, I think, in the book, I will go back to more examples and stuff, is that one size really doesn't fit all. I mean, people need to use their common sense, because even the most efficacious and pointed study, and, you know, because some of them are so biased, but even the most efficacious study can't possibly apply to every person. So it's a matter, isn't it, of us knowing our own bodies and doing our due diligence for who we are.
Yeah, that's really well said. And one thing I was surprised doing the research in this book of how tiny these swings are when they look at studies. So the headline might say such and such causes cancer. So to give a more concrete example, in the last few weeks, we saw some very scary headlines about bacon and bacon causing cancer. And if you look just at the headlines, you see, you know, bacon causes cancer. Oh my God, I better stop eating bacon. I don't want to die.
Well, I just want to add here that,
yeah,
Joe would never stop eating bacon, no matter what they say about
good
it.
Man. But good man.
Bonnie says that oink is going to be on my tombstone.
Okay, but go ahead, Jeff. I don't mean to interrupt you.
No, to your point, when you look, even the best of studies and analysis, and this bacon study that came out a few weeks ago now, that was a solid, large sample size analysis that seems to be, you know, a concrete takeaway. Okay, it's a link between bacon consumption and higher risk of some stomach cancer. But to your point, when you kind of look a little deeper and see how it actually affects the individual, if I didn't know any better, if I just saw the headline, bacon cancer, I think, wow, does that mean it's like a 50% chance I'm going to, you know, get cancer, 30%? What's the risk here? The base case in the first place of getting that kind of stomach cancer, whether you eat bacon every day or no bacon ever, is 5%. Now, the research found that would increase by 18% with bacon. you think 5 to 18%, boy, that's a big change. But no, it's actually that 5% is lifted by 18%, not to geek out in the math, but that's basically 5 times 1.18, which equals 6%. So it's a very different takeaway, baking causes cancer, to your risk of a stomach cancer goes from 5% to 6% maybe with bacon. So I'm in Joe's camp of, all right, 5%, that's practically a rounding error, so I'm going to enjoy the bacon. So it's back to doing what you know, what makes sense for you and your body.
Aren't some of these studies similar to, say, when two products are compared and they blow up the comparison, the percentage so much, so that it looks like a big graph, but actually that's like 10,000 times what a normal dosage or what a normal portion would be.
Yeah, that there are a hodgepodge of different kind of study concerns and biases, and that's a big one of if you say, all right, it's something, whether it's like some drug or some food, if you look at its impact on rats, it, you know, makes the rats go crazy or it kills the rats. Well, that's true, but that's a dosage of 10,000 times our average daily consumption. So I think if you eat anything, if I ate 10,000 times recommended kale, I'm going to die probably, right? It doesn't mean kale is bad. So I think you have to take all these studies, look at them a little bit deeper than the headline, and that sense of dosage is very important. If it's in the bacon case, in fairness, that one did say it's two slices a day might cause the risk. So they didn't say if you have 5 pounds of bacon a day, you're in trouble.
You know, unfortunately. I wanted to say that I never thought about this before reading your book, which is that this whole matter of health studies, why do you think that we as a culture are so obsessed with every study and every fad? And why do we keep doing the studies given their track record of error and being recanted? Isn't that
That's
like...
it's a great question. It does, on the surface, it seems kind of bonkers. Like, why do we care so much? And why are we obsessed about it? And B, how are there new studies all the time? And why do they go back and forth? And to kind of unpack that a bit, I think why we're obsessed, one just pet theory of mine is that thanks to the super warp speed information culture with, you know, Twitter and news all the time, we've kind of conditioned ourselves to expect new news about things we care about all the time, right? There's election news. There's new poll numbers. There's new gadget news. There's new car news. So because we have this, like, constant barrage of news in every other facet of our life, it's why wouldn't we have news on health too? You know, we want to stay healthy. So we like to, it's almost like we make an analogy because we have news and other like verticals, you know, of news of lifestyle and politics and world affairs. It seems logical there should be news about what we put into our bodies. But the reality is we already know actually a good chunk of what we have to know about being healthy. There's not news about fruit and vegetables and eggs in the same way there is news about politics every day. Not that much changes. So that's one issue. Second issue is that and I discussed in the book a little bit, the way publishing works amongst academia and scientists also helps contribute to this dynamic. And I think the scientists and doctors do an amazing job. We owe so much to them. But as one academic I spoke to described to me, in the world of research and academia, you want to publish in a weird way, the smaller the scope, the better. And there's a term, the ELP, the least publishable unit. Like you want to have your study be as narrow in scope as possible. Otherwise, it's almost impossible to do. So for example, if you're a scientist, it's almost impossible to do a study called is coffee bad or is coffee good? There are so many variables, and it's very hard to track that. What you can do though is say, all right, how does the consumption of coffee impact the percent chance that pregnant women might get a certain kind of cancer? That is a much more discrete, publishable scope of analysis. So when that, you know, 2 years later, that study comes out, that doctor gets a, you know, congratulations, good job. We run a story on it in the media, and you see coffee causes spike or decline in disease XYZ. And then a week later, there's some different small study of coffee that comes out exploring a different aspect of coffee. So all these studies are actually true or can be true and they can be consistent, but they all explore a different minor part of coffee impact. We rarely have a coffee good or bad study, if that makes any sense.
No, it makes as much sense as it can make in our culture. We're speaking with Jeff Wilser. He's an author and writer, and he's written, well, it's two books in one, The Good News About What's Bad For You. You flip it over and it's The Bad News About What's Good For You. A short break on today's Topical Currents. We'll be right back.
And we're back with Tuesday's edition of Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We're joined by Jeff Wilser again. His book, The Bad News About What's Good For You and The Good News About What's Bad For You. Jeff, we've kind of been focusing on food and drink, but let's get to this part of it. Is there something holistic about profanity and procrastination?
You know, it's... You wouldn't
I hope
think
so. But, I hope so.
but it's... No, happily, yes, there is. And I was thrilled to find this out. As my friends and family will tell could tell you, both of these cases, I indulge a lot, so it's good. There's good news about it. One scientist in the UK, he conducted this like fabulously goofy experiment where students dunked their hands in a tub of freezing water, right? And he had two groups of students doing this. One group of students just had their hands in there, and as their hands were in there, they yelled out a profanity word of their choosing again and again. The second group yelled out a any word they wanted that was harmless, like a potato chip. So then they compared how long the students could keep their hands in the freezing water. By the way, here I'm imagining this doctor, this cackling evil laugh, you know? It's that's right, a bit sadistic. Right. They found that the students who were dropping F-bombs could actually hold their hands in water a longer period of time. And he's done other experiments similar to this, suggesting that, and his theory is that profanity is a type of language. These words have the power to actually tap into a different region of our brain that accesses emotions easier. And so this can have a physiological effects and can actually impact our body. So, his reason for doing this is when his wife went into labor years ago, he noticed she was cussing like a sailor. And he's like, why? Huh, that's interesting. You know, there must be a biological reason for this. Like, we don't tend to do things unless there's an evolutionary reason. Right. So his theory is profanity helps us cope with pain. So perhaps we can cope with pain better when we are cussing. So for your listeners, next time you're screaming out, you know, F-bombs, know that this is a biological function, so good job.
Or maybe putting together an IKEA kit or something like that.
Oh, my God. That's
painful.
Worst.
Well, what about the other one Joe mentioned? I'm sure people will be thrilled to know there are benefits of procrastination. What are they?
Yeah, so I was deeply skeptical when I heard this. It sounded too good to be true. The psychologist who wrote a book on this subject, his theory, is the art of delay, he calls it, is that often when we put things off, one of three things can happen. So the example he gives me, and I'll give to us, is imagine you're a lawyer and you have some brief to write. And let's say it's due in a month. If you could do it right away, but let's say you know it'll take you 2 days to do. Now, one thing that could happen is that the case settles somehow next month. If you do it right away, you wasted your time. So, all right. Second, that's not likely, but it could happen. Second thing that might happen is you might gain new information and insight, or more data can come into the equation. So if you jump the gun and do it right away, you might miss key info that'd be helpful in the future. But a third and really most impactful benefit, and we see this the most often, is that you might while thinking about the case, just in the shower, next weekend, you might have some thought you didn't have right away. And that by intentional delay, that can allow us time for us to let our thoughts marinate and breathe, to mix a metaphor. And so the overall result might be better in the end. Now, he's quick to point out, as I say in the book, this doesn't mean we should just blow off everything for as long as we can and sit around on the couch. But if it's an active procrastination where we say, all right, I am, as opposed to trying to knock things off my to-do list right away, I'm going to like deliberately give this some time. There can be benefits to that as opposed to just cramming things away and knocking off our email inbox right away.
Well, I want to go back to some substances. Like, I thought one of the most jarring examples in your book was verboten nicotine, because that one now, so tell us a lowdown on that, which of course you're not telling people to go start smoking.
Yeah, and in fact, I devote a lot of space saying every study in the world has shown smoking is bad. That's not one of the things that, oh, there's good news about this. No, there's no good news about smoking. That said, one neuroscientist I interviewed, her research suggests that, and she also says, yes, cigarettes are terrible. However, nicotine itself, so not smoking, but nicotine could, especially in folks who have either Parkinson's or potentially elderly, nicotine is a substance that could help blunt cognitive decline. So there are actual legit trials out there right now that are giving folks with Parkinson's a nicotine patch to see how their functioning changes over time. And in fact, the Michael J. Fox Parkinson's Foundation is actually sponsoring one of these trials. So again, smoking, don't do it. Kids out there, don't smoke. Stay in school. Say no to drugs. But the actual substance of nicotine might have some neurological benefit.
Does it really make a difference if I pay more to get organic fruits and vegetables?
Yeah, it depends who you ask, and that is certainly a hot button issue. And I should say, I live in Brooklyn, where I was, you know, worried I would be not legally allowed to live there in the land of organic and local kale, right? So I'd be kicked out.
Right.
Multiple studies have shown that when you look at the nutritional contents of organic versus non-organic, there's almost no difference. Stanford had a large study about this a few years ago, and it sent a shudder through the health world. Now, the flip side is the same studies show actually organic foods do have more pesticides. Lower pesticides than non-organic foods. But then the question, as you pointed out earlier, is the dosage high enough to matter, right? So if, yes, it's true that organic foods have lower levels of pesticides, but if the pesticide level in conventional vegetables is already at a safe, low level, does that really matter? And different folks have different viewpoints on that. The health experts that I spoke to largely said it doesn't matter that much. But again, that's a certainly personal preference comes into play there.
Now, you mentioned coffee before. Where do things stand with coffee today? Is it still good for us this week in moderation?
Thank God it's still good for us.
And for me, I
probably have it in not moderation, and I'm okay with that. But yeah, that's what I think's ironic about coffee is people, like most people who drink coffee, which is most people that I know, we think, well, yeah, I drink coffee, but it's geez, I should really cut down, or I feel bad about it. We almost view coffee as a shameful crutch. And what I found interesting is that given that study after study after study highlights the benefits of coffee, including there's neurological benefits, there's sharper memory. Obviously, we're all quicker, and I think folks who drink coffee know that we feel more awake and we feel more alive, and studies back that up. And there's also correlative evidence that links with longer lifespans and better health in general. So I guess my question is, given that the evidence says coffee is good for us, and given that we tend to enjoy having coffee, why do we feel bad about it? Why do I feel like, oh, I should give up coffee now? Maybe just not give it up and enjoy it and feel proud that you're enjoying, proud that you're being healthy.
Well, exactly. Maybe when they read your book, they'll not keep trying to kick the habit, as they call it. Speaking with Jeff Wilser, he's an author and writer. He's written two books and one, The Good News About What's Bad For You and The Bad News About What's Good For You. We'll be right back.
Minutes past 1 o'clock. It's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Jeff Wilser. If you'd like to join in our discussion, that's easy enough. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. Or email, that's radio at WLRN.org. Now, Jeff, this is a little bit beyond my generational stretch, but you say there could be some benefits derived from the drug ecstasy and the rave culture that goes along with it. How does that work?
Well, again, plenty of disclaimers here, right? Nowhere in the book am I saying we should do drugs of any kind, except for coffee, if you want to call that a drug. But one British, high-ranking British health expert who was he had this theory, and he crunched the numbers. He said, all right, I'm just curious, what is more dangerous, doing ecstasy or horseback riding? And so he found all of the various injuries and deaths by riding horseback and looked at how much horseback riding was happening in the UK. Then he found out how many health problems were caused by, you know, kids who were taking ecstasy. And he found that on a per capita basis or a per usage basis, horseback riding is far more dangerous than doing ecstasy. So, and he also, and that, you know, the parliament was not too thrilled with that analysis, as you can imagine. He also many of Britain's top experts on these issues ranked all of the various drugs out there, looking at damage to oneself and one's community. And he was, you know, he was imagining that the usual suspects would be the most damaging, of heroin and crystal meth and cocaine and all that stuff. He was surprised to find that when you actually include damage to others, alcohol was top of the list. And obviously things like drinking and driving would contribute to that. So his point was not that we should do drugs. And he makes very explicit that this is a risky thing and drugs can be bad for us. And I also double down on that message. There's a very much a drugs are bad message. That said, his kind of more nuanced message is we tend to think oddly about risk, and we tend to say everything is either good or bad. And in the case of ecstasy, he thought, you know, maybe that's not as we should be demonized as much as it is. And other studies show there is not the neurological impact people had thought.
Well, what about something that's supposed to be good? I mean, it's a craze, kind of, this vitamin water. That, and especially the serving size part of it. Tell us about that and the ice cream thing.
Oh, yeah. That's one of my favorites. Yeah. Talk about branding and spinning things, right? So this has changed a bit in the past few years. But when vitamin water first came out, it had more sugar, it had more carbs than, or as much carbs as a can of Coke. And so it's called vitamins, but they were as, you might as well drink a can of soda and call it, you know, vitamin soda or this healthy cola. So in fact, when When Coca-Cola was sued by a group about this issue, the lawyers said, in this defense to Coke, they said, there is no way that any, and I'm paraphrasing here, but they said, there's no way that anyone would reasonably think that vitamin water is healthy. That was part of their legal defense. So there are things like, and I don't want to pick on just vitamin water, and they certainly have, since then, they have more lower-cal and lower-carb options. We tend to look at things like smoothies versus ice cream and juices versus ice cream. And because one thing is called a juice, or like apple juice or a smoothie, we think, oh, that must be healthy, when often it can have just as much sugar as the ice cream itself. So if you know, my take, again, not a doctor, but if the ice cream and the smoothie have comparable levels of sugar, might as well have the one that you actually enjoy. This is one key point I make in a book is, we tend to beat ourselves up to be healthy, even when our quote unquote healthy option isn't that much healthier than the alternative.
Well, speaking of things that we pressure ourselves to be, and other ones to be happy, and there are some costs of being happy. So talk about that.
Yeah, that's back to the idea of trade-offs. And everything has a trade-off, even something like what seems like an unblemished good like happiness. I mean, the pursuit of happiness is in the Declaration of Independence. But a variety of studies, kind of social experiments from psychologists, have suggested folks who are actively trying to pursue happiness or think that almost the happiness chasers, that can backfire, and that can make us feel like we are unsatisfied. So it suggests that almost a more zen approach of, okay, maybe I'm already in good shape, and maybe I don't need to be kind of optimizing every last decision in life, and maybe the relentless chasing of happiness can have certain downsides to it. And I think that's, for me, that was comforting, because it says that, you know, maybe if I don't feel all the time, I am not feeling like in blissful happiness, and maybe I feel at times bad about that, I shouldn't, because good thing. If I was happier, I'd be less happy, or some weird paradox like that.
And then the idea of being more productive and more creative when you're not happy, like the suffering artist, which has some credence.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's not a coincidence, and as some folks in the book point out, not a coincidence that a lot of the best art and work has come from those tortured artists. That's a real thing. Pain and melancholy can yield real fruit. You tend to not see a lot of the greatest works of art and creations from just smiling folks who are just as happy as clams. You just don't see that very often.
Oh, my. Okay, so what about this gossip one? What were the benefits of gossiping?
Yeah,
there's an evolutionary reason for that.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. I found this fascinating that the evolutionary theory is that when other animals, when they nurture their young, they are in close physical proximity, and they are they're with one another all the time, and they have nonverbal communication to kind of stay together and solidify the bonds of family and community. With humans, we do less of that kind of pawing and petting, for better or worse, and we tend to speak more. And so theory is it's that that kind of chit chat is part of what bonds us in families and larger, broader families in society. And to make this more concrete and modernized, in the workplace, we think of gossip as an evil thing. And at times, it certainly can be, right? We've all been the victim of gossip, or we all know those mean girl gossipers, and that can certainly be vile. But a less appreciated aspect of gossip is that it can help convey and establish the norms of a culture. So in the workplace, we might see in the HR packet, okay, I know that I shouldn't do certain activity, and that might be on page 42, subclause B. But the real thing is, we know, all right, if I hook up with so-and-so at the holiday party, that's going to be gossiped about. So it's the gossip that helps instill those codes of behavior more so than the actual written laws.
Let's turn to, we're jumping around here, but herbal supplements. There's really no regulation of the ingredients. What's on the label and what's in the bottle can be completely different. And also, there really aren't any studies that show that any of them really work. Is that correct?
Yeah, you hit it right there. Those are the two non-trivial issues with herbal supplements. One is that, as the expert I spoke to said, there is no solid evidence, no mainstream peer-reviewed study suggesting there's any real benefit to these things. There's plenty of anecdotal claims. There's plenty of someone says, "Oh, I tried this, now I feel amazing." But the real pernicious issue is the first thing you mentioned about regulation. And I think it's because we as humans, understandably, we have this bias toward natural. And we think if something is all natural, then it must be good for us. So because herbal supplements can often say, "Oh, it's just natural products. It's been used for centuries or thousands of years in various countries," we think, "Ah, okay, you know, working 2,000 years, good enough for me." But that doesn't mean, because it's not a pharmaceutical, it's not subject to the same regulation that drug companies have to go through. Therefore, these quote-unquote natural substances can be blended together in God knows what combinations and can be doing things to our body that's less rigorously examined. And again, you can rub like dirt over your arm. If you have a cut on your arm, you can rub it with dirt, and that might be a natural technique. It doesn't mean it's going to work.
We're speaking with Jeff Wilser, an author and writer. He's written The Good News About What's Bad For You. Flip it over, and it's The Bad News About What's Good For You. Our last break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Jeff Wilser, the author of The Good News About What's Bad For You and The Bad News About What's Good For You. Okay, so Jeff, we have to get to this. You talked about the weird doctor doing the experiment with the hands in the freezing water.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about your pretty weird experiment. Because, okay, you did a 30-day mission. And tell us what you did and what you wanted to accomplish.
Yeah, my mission was, as you mentioned, way weirder than the profanity doctor guy. So for 30 days, actually 33 days, I ate only four food groups. I ate junk food, black coffee, protein shakes, and whiskey, and nothing else. No bread,
Scotch
no
or bourbon.
Meat. Bourbon generally,
okay.
But I went back and forth, but mostly bourbon.
Okay.
I can't, in the experiment, I can't parse out the difference between those two variables, I suppose. So no vegetables, no fruit, no dairy. And in those 33 days, I lost 11 pounds. So the one key catch here is that I ate all this junk food. However, I ate it all in portion control, and I capped my caloric intake to a certain level every day, and I tracked everything. I mean, I can assure you, wildly embarrassing. I was going on some dates, and so I would be like, you know, tracking my bourbon or tracking. Like, she would want a cheeseburger and I can only eat a milkshake. That's all my diet could allow.
Or M&M's or something?
M&M's, absolutely. A key part of my diet, M&M's, Oreos. I said Oreos for breakfast, Snickers for lunch, things like Cracker Jacks, Tostita chips. And I ate it all in moderation. And so I know we hate the idea of, oh, moderation and all things. I know it's boring, but in this case, when we look at the world of food and weight gain or weight loss, we tend to obsess about the quality of our food. Is it organic or not organic? Is it white bread or wheat bread? GMO, non-GMO, gluten-free or gluten? And these are not bad questions, right? Like, I get it. It is important to ask these questions. But we tend to obsess about the minutiae and nuance and not really look at the big picture of quantity of food. And so my experiment was, in these two variables of quality and quantity of food, what happens when we kind of punt on the quality and say, all right, I'm going to eat this crap, but I will eat it in a very responsible quantity. And I found that you could lose a good deal of weight. So it's not to say that weight is the only thing that matters, of course, but it does suggest that it can, in a way, be simpler than we think it is.
But talk about the other result. It wasn't just that you lost 11 pounds, which your doctor said was not a good idea in 33
right.
days, but you had other, like, blood tests, too.
Yeah, yeah. So I got measurements before and after. I tested blood pressure, cholesterol, all that good stuff. And at the beginning of the month, so in those 33 days, my bad cholesterol went down, my good cholesterol went up, and my body fat percentage also declined. So by every measurable standard, I got healthier, which there is one exception. The one exception is on day 29, I happened to be getting a haircut. And I told my barber a little too proudly, I haven't had any like real food in a month. I've only been eating, you know, Snickers and Oreos. And the barber says, I can tell, man, your hair is thinning.
Ah.
What? He said, oh, yeah, it's even your eyebrows are thinner. So I don't know if he was messing this day. I don't know if he was messing with me or not, but it's possible that the junk food cleanse might cause hair loss.
Did you have some big cravings, though, for, say, a good salad or some roasted asparagus or a steak or something?
Yeah, it's funny. I thought I was going to, and I told my mom, you know, yeah, I really thought I'd be craving salad. She said, Jeff, no one has ever craved salad.
That's not true.
Well, it what's the dark side of this is that it made me realize how the engineers who design these junk foods are evil geniuses, and they actually calibrate something called the bliss points. That's an optimal mix of sugar and
salt
and savoriness. And so we want saltiness. And so things like Doritos and Oreos, there's a reason why we want to eat more and more of those. They've been designed to want this cheap kind of gunky food. But I think, though, that my admittedly stupid experiment, which, by the way, was inspired by a professor of nutrition at Kansas State named Dr. Mark Hobb, who did a similar study a few years ago, but he lost 29 pounds in 10 weeks. So both of us now have done this and both had similar results. But the larger point is that we tend to blame certain foods as being evil. And we look at foods like kale as kind of this knights in shining armor. This will make us healthier. When the reality is, it's a little simpler than that. It's actually, you can eat food that's quote unquote bad as long as you don't overdo it. And just because you have these angel foods like full of antioxidants, that's not a guarantee you're being healthier. It's just eating in smart portions and not obsessing about the minutiae so much.
Well, you say, you say crappy food isn't the enemy, excess is. So,
exactly.
Yeah. Speaking of antioxidants, talk about the green tea thing? Because that's something our listeners should know about.
Yeah, I think that most studies have shown that green tea, in crazy high quantities, that can have can make your teeth brittle. One study has shown. So that's something to, if you drink, you know, 20 or 30 glasses a day, maybe watch out. But for the rest of us, the larger issue is that the authentic, real green tea, most studies show, yeah, that's pretty good for you. However, there are plenty of cheap imitations out there, not the real McCoys, that kind of steal the green tea's good name and are kind of an excuse to smuggle in sugar and basically make it more like a soda. And so one study from the New York Times a couple of years ago looked at all the various different teas out there on the market and showed, one, they don't have the ingredients that they say they do, when they actually, doctors and scientists analyzed the components and found didn't quite add up to what the label said. And two, sometimes they are just smuggling in extra sugar.
So it's, I mean, you talk about that main antioxidant, the ECGC, and you say it's not even in a lot of these products.
Exactly.
So how does one know?
Yeah, it's unsettling, right? If you look at the label and the label's not there, what do you do? I think that in this case, the more natural green tea, as opposed to a, I don't want to blast any particular brands or labels, but the Snapple type substances that are green tea-esque is probably not as healthy as actual, honest to God,
the stuff in gas stations and the quickie marts and that.
Right, exactly. Well, junk food cleanse green tea is probably not as good for you, put it that way.
Yeah, right. We've been speaking with Jeff Wilser. He's an author and writer. His work has appeared in print and online in New York Magazine, GQ, Esquire, Los Angeles Times, Chicago Tribune, Huffington Post, among other publications. And he's written two books in one, The Good News About What's Bad for You, which you flip over, and you find The Bad News About What's Good for You. So, Jeff, by the way, did you exercise during your junk food cleanse?
I did, but no more or less than usual. Okay. So I rode my bike around to work. I jogged here and there, but that was the same activities I did beforehand.
All right. Well, Jeff Wilser, it's been a pleasure.
My pleasure, guys. Show is all good news. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
And that wraps up today's edition. It was produced by Richard Ive, technical direction by online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio archives of all our programs. You can find them at the station website, that's WLRN.org. Link the archives through radio and Topical Currents. Also, check out the Topical Currents Facebook page for links, photos, and discussion. Tomorrow's program is a rebroadcast of one of our All in a Day's Work features. We'll learn more about the harrowing work of paramedics. Our guests are paramedics Kevin Grange, who's written a book about the profession, and also Palm Beach Fire Department certified paramedic Tim Durham.
Are you going to eat bacon tonight, Joe?
No.
And feel better about it?
No, but I'm going to procrastinate. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.